From the Sky News Centre at 6, a jury has found ex-TV weatherman Fred Talbot guilty of indecent assaults on two teenage boys in the 1970s. They were molested on trips on canal boats he'd organised as a school teacher in Cheshire. The 65-year-old was questioned about diary entries from his time at the school, which suggested inappropriate behaviour. Richard Scorer is a lawyer who deals with cases of child abuse.
I think certainly in other cases where we've seen this kind of behaviour, there has been an aspect of it which is around the trophy, you know, celebrating what they're doing and the fact that they're able to get away with it despite knowing, as Talbot clearly did, that it was totally wrong.
Former Guantanamo Bay prisoner Moazzam Begg is urging Britain to do everything it can to get another detainee released. Shaka Armour has been held in the notorious jail for 13 years without trial. The Saudi citizen's family, who live in the UK, have pleaded with the US government for his release. They've got the backing of Pink Floyd founder Roger Waters.
People like Shaka Armour can be left to rot in some prison cell somewhere without anybody even being allowed to ask the question, why? What is it that this man has done, apart from having the wrong-sounding name and being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Fierce fighting in eastern Ukraine has killed at least 25 people since yesterday, ahead of a planned ceasefire this weekend. Russian-backed separatists have mounted a major sustained offensive to capture a strategic railway hub. It's thought an increase in ethnic minorities is partly behind a rise in the number of people who don't drink alcohol. A survey's found almost a third of young people now say they're teetotal, up from a fifth 10 years ago. The head of HSBC has described the scandal over its Swiss arm this week as painful and frustrating. Its chief executive made the comment in a memo to the bank's staff, where he also admits HSBC's failed to live up to expected standards. And Andy Murray's been knocked out of the ATP tennis in Rotterdam in the quarterfinals. He lost to Gilles Simon 6-4, 6-2. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Punch Touring presents the third annual Soul Acoustic Tour, celebrating the best in live soul music across the UK. On Tuesday the 10th of March at the Snug Bar in Bristol, featuring the Queen of Lovers Rock, Carol Thompson, Koth, Raheem Bakari, Dion Reed, Eva Lazarus, Silverstone and Stephanie McCourt. For more information, jump online.
punch-records.co.uk.
The third annual Soul Acoustic Tour, coming this March.
Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
I'm Caroline. I'm one of the St Peter's Hospice community nurse specialists. I visit patients in their homes or where they're living. The patients we look after have life-limiting illnesses, and my role is to enhance the quality of life for all patients by offering specialist symptom control, psychological support, family support, close liaison, and support with the GPs and district nurses. St Peter's Hospice, we have four community nurse specialist teams working in different parts of Bristol and the surrounding area, and we work alongside the wider hospice team to ensure that the levels of the hospice services are utilised appropriately to meet all the patients' needs. The CNS team work very closely with the primary healthcare team, so that's GPs, district nurses, as well as the acute hospital palliative care teams, to make sure and ensure that there's a seamless ongoing support for patients and their carers. Find out more about the work of St Peter's Hospice at stpetershospice.org. St Peter's Hospice, for patients, families, and all the communities of Bristol.
The science of causing change to occur by means of one's will. The sinister reputation attaching to it is entirely groundless and is based on superstition rather than objective observation. The power of the will is something people do not understand, attributing to it mysterious qualities which it does not possess. Being merely the power of mind over matter, or in the greater number of cases, the power of mind over mind.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Will the police really charge senior Tories and civil servants with child sex abuse in the run-up to May's general election? Today today, Anonymous has what they call Op Death Eaters Rally in London, hoping to flush more child abusers out. But will the police really prosecute these senior Tories? We'll find out. Also, more on NATO's cop killers as we take a look at US declassified plans to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba called Operation Northwoods. More from Swiss professor Daniele Ganso, who's been studying NATO's secret armies for almost 20 years. And as the Cold War hots up, we hear from a musician who was commenting on the old Cold War. What did John Lennon make of it all? Plus, CIA whistleblower Stephen D. Kelly says ISIS is a fabricated enemy and could be economically shut down tomorrow if NATO really wanted. So why haven't we seen him on our TV screens? And is ISIS just a Trojan horse to get NATO troops into Syria by other means? Quiet regime change this week. Not much media coverage of the last month's unrest and recent coup in Yemen. So, will the real police really prosecute senior Tories and civil servants, and even royals? Several survivors allege sexual abuse took place in Buckingham Palace itself in the run-up to the general election. Well, to discuss that and other things, we hear now from abuse survivor Sam Hill. Hi, Sam, and welcome.
Hi there. Hi, Tony.
Welcome to the Politics Show.
Yes, I've experienced power abuse from the institutions, and I wrote a book about it 6 years ago. It's called An Oath to Hell. It's available on Amazon. My experience is that it's status abuse, really, and the abusers know full well that it previously could play the institutions. It's generally in Britain, I think, is about keeping up appearances, and very often an abuser will have more inclination and desire to wish to do that. And obviously a survivor may be, you know, off the rails and suffering emotionally. So they use that advantage, and it is used by the state as well.
Okay, so you say there's status abuse. That's not a term I'm familiar with. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of anti-victim prejudice. When you try and recover from abuse, firstly, you have to deal with the fallout in your own family. And if that's successful, if you're nurtured, you can hope to progress. But then if you're not, if you're in an institution, they tend to have an attitude whereby they make their money and they earn the livings from keeping people who have been in, you know, what could be described as damaged in submission. And of course there are some wonderful people working within the institutions, but it can be said that it's very difficult within an institution, especially if you've encountered an abuser within an institution, to actually get it out. You imagine being a whistleblower with a job. You try doing that as a child or someone within an institution and see what happens. It's not pleasant.
Okay, give us just a brief idea, just a couple of minutes, of explain what happened to you and what age did it start?
Well, I mean, I was 11 or so when I was started becoming groomed. My grandparents moved to a wealthy neighbourhood, and I got to know some of the local children there, and one of them took his dog for a walk, and his neighbour was somebody I knew through a friend at school. I was asked to be a helper at a children's party, and I experienced organised abuse at these parties. I didn't actually know what it was then, but as time has gone on, I've known. Luckily, there were only two occasions I'd encountered this. But I was unable to take it forward because of it being swept under the carpet by family and various other means of silencing.
Well, that's pretty horrible to hear it being swept under the carpet by your family. Horrible stuff. Yeah. But give us an idea of what was actually, when you're saying this, you know, without going into too much detail, what sort of abuse are we talking about?
Well, there were men exposing themselves at the top of the stairs for a start. We were told to go and knock on the door and open it, several of us. That kind of scale. I don't really want to go into too much detail, but that's the kind of scale it was. And there were children at one of the parties who none of us knew, and they came down half-dressed, and they were not talking. They were crawling around on the floor. We were told we'd be taken to someone else's house, but luckily, another person at the party prevented that from happening. There were children's parties. And you know, one of the people I got to know a few years through being controlled by him after this, that they asked, do you want us to help run your children's party? But the thing is, they had powerful friends. They had friends who were GPs in the neighbourhood. And believe me, with the amount of information sharing, and the amount of will to keep things quiet. It's not hard to do when you're dealing with powerful people, and it's very difficult to get your voice heard.
Well, I know you mentioned, and I had a chat on the phone to you yesterday about actually connections with Eton, because this is one of the real problems, isn't it? That a lot of the most powerful people in the country actually go through that school.
Yes, I know. I mean, it was the same era as one of the Havers brothers was there, that the two brothers I knew were there. I can't imagine what went on to make them turn that way. You know, I don't know. I can't imagine whether it's there was an element of we are so superior, nothing matters, that I experienced when I was with in contact with these two. You know, we were supposed to be grateful, you know, that they were showing interest in us, that kind of thing. It was bizarre.
I mean, as simple as the idea of you know, obviously all young children want to go to a children's party, and that was actually then used as a kind of vector for abuse to go on.
Yes, it was. It's horrific. And as I say, luckily, there are only two occasions where I was exposed to this, but yes.
I mean, you know, surely the parents, any parents involved would, you know, would twig that something dodgy was going on. I mean, what happened within your own family, for example?
Well, I didn't exactly discuss it. I didn't even have the language to really know exactly what was happening. I had flashbacks of what happened for many years. We were taken out of the party and prevented from being taken to another house. And it's difficult to know. You're kind of almost silenced by your own voice, by your own sort of lack of ability to describe it, especially at that age.
And so did a much older man then start a relationship of some sort with you?
Yeah, that's the way they can manage it, because then they have a hold on you and can sort of control your emotions a bit better.
But you were very young. I mean, how much older was he?
Yes, 19 years older.
He's about 30, something
yeah.
like that. Anyway, surely your parents would have twigged something was wrong there.
Yes, I don't know. I do remember conversations about it vaguely. You overhear conversations as a kid, because, I mean, I wasn't really included on them. They were saying, oh, well, maybe it's better to let her get on with it and heal rather than, you know, digging it up, making therapy and going to court and stuff. I don't know whether it was their own modesty and wanting to keep up appearances, or if it was for my own good, or what misguided them, really, or whether they realised the people involved were powerful. My family were kind of a bit modest and quite young. They didn't really like talking about things very much. You know, they were Masons as well, so I don't know if that had anything to do with it.
Well, that's interesting, yeah, because Freemasonry, I mean, I've certainly come across that quite a lot as being one of the, you know, children of Freemasons being involved. So you're saying your parents were Freemasons,
yes, they were,
or their
yeah.
friends?
That was another thing I wasn't supposed to talk about.
You are, oh, really? Freemasonry?
Not so, supposed to tell people that they were Masons, no.
So, I mean, do you think that there is some sort of Masonic connection? Because it's a secret society,
well, I used to
isn't
sit
it?
Opposite head of the police at Christmas dinners on several occasions, yeah. But, I mean, I don't know how far it went, because every time I tried to contact the police, the record of my interviews and investigations, they were not recorded. So
you have had a go
yeah.
at going through the official route, going to the police, telling them that abuse has been going on. What happened? Nothing.
Well, I mean, I had a breakdown at 19. It was all very convenient for my family. And, you know, the generic diagnosis of how you present in psychiatry is kind of held over you pretty much forever. So,
I mean, have you had...
at 19...
I just wondered if you'd found that there were some professionals that were actually able to help and help
no,
you through
I
it.
No, I really didn't. I tried. I couldn't find it. But then it was always a struggle, you know, trying to find somewhere to live, because I left home pretty much at 16. I went back occasionally in my teens, but I left home and lived in Denmark at 16, and then I struggled to try and find myself somewhere to live and just survive. It was really difficult. Because that's another reason why abusers know they can get away with it. You spend a lot of time sometimes just recovering. I didn't get into drugs or do anything like, or actually homeless or do anything too much, but it was just a struggle to survive. And they've got that advantage over you, because
yeah.
it takes a few years to get back on your feet, really, if you're unlucky.
Yeah, so you had to struggle with virtually no money. I mean, how did you earn a living, for example?
Concentration wasn't very good. For a while, and then I started having flashbacks. But I mean, I managed to hold down jobs occasionally, part-time jobs, and struggled my way through life. Really, I can't really explain it now. But yeah.
Sam, what were your thoughts when a couple of years ago the whole Jimmy Savile scandal?
Oh,
broke?
That was a revelation. That was for years thinking it was me and my limited group of friends who had also seen victimised by the state. I'd had friends who'd been survivors of child sex abuse. and they'd been pushed into the mental health system by, you know, at the point of having a fight with their father, for instance, who was an abuser, and then doctors called. So I'd seen direct, you know, repercussions of child sex abuse going on around me and the way the state handled it, and thought that was disgusting. But to realise it's gone on a large scale, it really opened my eyes. It was dreadful to say, but it was almost a relief. You think, my God, I'm not alone. I can speak. People won't think I'm mad. That's the danger. You worry that people are going to think you're crazy.
Well, I mean, if the BBC Newsnight editor Peter Rippon had his way, no one would have known about it. I wonder what you think of the fallout from that, which includes this inquiry which was begun back last summer by Theresa May into the systematic abuse by the state.
Yes, I think society's got to adjust, and I think it's got to take time. It can't snap into understanding what's been going on straight away. These are like hard entrenched sort of attitudes between them and us, really. Those who have power and those who sort of dare to criticise it. But I think it's changing, and I think I haven't given up on the government inquiry. I'm quite saddened that they think that survivors shouldn't be on the panel because they're not going to be objective enough, and they shouldn't choose the chair because they may be too emotional. I've heard all these attitudes, you know, in the news, but I haven't given up on it as a concept. I think something has got to happen. We've just got to start somewhere.
The only trouble is, of course, we've got a general election in the offing, haven't
yeah.
we?
Yeah, and that's going to take a lot of the emphasis away, isn't it, from doing anything. But I don't think the survivors are going to let people forget, and I don't think the public is going to forget now. So all we can hope is that this is going to generate some movement.
I just wonder, I mean, if you've got solace from chatting with other survivors from different parts of the country, maybe even from quite near to where you grew up, to share the burden a bit.
Yes, I have. I have done... Well, online recently and with friends. So I've, you know, unfortunately one of my friends died. He was a victim of child abuse. He was treated very badly by the state. He was turned into public enemy number one, but he was a lovely guy to the people who knew him. He had a difficult life. I've shared it with people. I've got some very strong friendships, but the ones I made online recently have been very interesting. Yeah, Teresa Cooper, who was, you know, again medicated and abused in an institution. She's been a great support to me. She's given me legal advice and help, all sorts of help.
So that, I mean, this is another hideous aspect to all of this, is that sometimes the victims of child sexual abuse over the years have been actually treated as sort of patients and then been told, well, actually, you know, you're going to need some kind of treatment. So what happened to you?
Well, yeah, I was given huge amounts of medication, the stuff that they give to Soviet prisoners. Back in 89, when I had my breakdown, I was 19, I was given huge amounts of Stelazine. And Stelazine, as I said, is used for political dissidents. It knocks you out. It makes you soulless, basically. It's one of the ones that Teresa Cooper was given as a 14-year-old, which is highly illicit. But, yeah, nasty stuff. Put on 3 stone in weight in 6 months. You stop thinking. Debilitates you.
That was some sort of treatment program. Did they put it across like that?
Well, they offer people. It was in. It's got a bad reputation. This place that I was at. They've shut them all down now, haven't they? But yeah.
Okay. So, what are your thoughts about this? Going back to the child sexual abuse inquiry, what are your thoughts about what would make that work and what would not? Because as you've just now said, you know, there are problems with actually getting survivors onto the panel, and it seems pretty clear that you're going to have at least one or two survivors there in order for it to have credibility.
Yes, I know, but then I've always sort of tried to wonder whether there's going to be dispute about which survivors and whether they're fully representative. I think it's wrong that they don't have any, but on the other hand, we just have to, I think, calm ourselves and see something is happening. I think it's the rage, it's the way that we've all been treated in the past. We've been told to go away, we've been told to be quiet, and we can see this all being done, you know, by the state again. But I think in some ways we really ought to try and take a deep breath and see that there will be progress, and that we'll just keep calm about whatever they do. And when something's happening, if it's not done properly, then we can start getting angry and upset.
Now, tell us a little bit about your life now, because as a survivor, hopefully, anyway, you've managed to pull your life around to become to lead a relatively normal, happy life.
Yeah, I think this is it, you see. I think this is why they call us survivors. I think the lucky ones who do survive, we stand a good chance of becoming stronger and wiser, especially now with these things being in the open in the press. I think that's going to help a lot of people, hopefully. Yeah, I've got my life back together, and it can be done.
And as someone that's been through all this, what advice have you got for people out there who maybe think that maybe somebody that they know may have been abused, or what are the warning signs?
I think if somebody's quiet, I was very quiet and well-disciplined, it can happen in many different ways. I think some people can become outrageously kind of extrovert and some people can be very quiet. I was very quiet. I think you just, if you can't communicate with them clearly, if you've got to try and... I think I was obviously not communicating clearly, even my friends would have known, but they wouldn't have known why. I think if you can't get a good channel of communication with someone, then you might realise something might not be right.
Finally, Sam, this Freemason connection that you brought up, I mean, it's something that we've discussed on this show many times, all sorts of corruption, because basically within the Masonic lodges, they swear oaths, Freemasons, that means that they will protect the secrets of Freemasonry and their fellow Freemasons. And I don't personally think that these people are fit for public office since they've sworn those oaths, actually, which shut the public out. So what have you learnt over the years about, you know, about the possible connections of Freemasonry to this kind of abuse?
I'm not so sure. I suppose there are a lot of powerful people who are connected, and with a common cause, they're going to make things happen. They're going to pull strings. I've seen enough strings pulled within social services, mental health, to know that that strings get pulled by the authorities and institutions anyway. Whether you can say solely the Masons, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of secrets within the Masons.
But I suppose my question is more, how do you break that?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. How do you break it? I think I can't answer that one. It's horrible. I don't like secret societies at all. I don't know. How can you break it?
I suppose
if you're not getting justice repeatedly, try and expose it, I suppose.
Well, I suppose there may be also the courtroom type of situation, which could force people to expose that they have been colluding in the cover up of child abuse. That's the only way I can think of.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of change in the law, hasn't there? I mean, mandatory reporting, that would be a good one. If people could disclose whistleblowers and sort of have protection for them. But I don't know how you'd ever get people to expose that they're Freemasons, would they? Is that what you meant?
Well, I've got a little book,
okay.
I may be able to do a bit of that. And I think that's actually quite important, because it's the provincial yearbooks for the various Masonic areas, provinces they have, but rather similar to the ordinary counties, and each one has its own yearbook, which has got them all listed in there. So, some use for that. Anyway, how do people follow your work online then, Sam?
Well, I'm Sam Hill on Twitter, and I'm Sam Hill 1970 on YouTube. I've got several videos up there. And I'm free to talk to people if they're interested.
Okay, Sam, thanks ever so much for joining us on the Politics Show. Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is quite a surprise to me, actually, tonight, genuinely, that Freemasonry is involved here too. I was chatting to somebody who's in contact with an abuse victim as well, whose parents were Freemasons, and that person was one of the people who's alleged to have been abused at Buckingham Palace. But ultimately, this is not going to come out, is it, in the run-up to a general election, because so many senior Conservative figures are alleged to be involved here?
Well, look, you've got to be careful about this. If people are going to be accused of very, very serious crimes, you can't rush it, or it's obviously been delayed, but this is going to run and run. It's not just about a general election, and it's not just about the Tory party. It's about the abuse of power, full stop. And Freemasonry may be involved, but what we're really interested in here, what I think is the key thing that people need to grasp, is that elite paedophilia is linked to political manipulation. That's the real thing. I mean, I heard earlier on the news that the inquiry is going to be widened now to include Scotland and Northern Ireland, so that the Kinkora Boys' Home can be included in the inquiry. And the allegations are at the Kinkora Boys' Home, as pointed out in Ken Livingstone's maiden speech in the House of Commons in the 1990s, I think, it was being used by MI5 as a honey trap. So they were using it to blackmail mainly loyalist paramilitaries, although a suggestion has now been made that other politicians were blackmailed by having sex with underage boys at the children's home and then blackmailed. And there is what you might call people using their position of power to abuse others, like the teacher that was being grilled in the news item, the Sky News earlier. But the thing that really people need to get their heads around is that the use of paedophilia as a political tool is at the heart of all of this. And
so this goes right to the top. I mean, we were talking to Stuart Siveray, weren't we, last summer about this. He's the senator from Jersey, and he was saying that they've appealed countless times to the royal family, who actually make the key appointments in the Channel Islands, that these people have got to go because they've been covering up systematic child abuse on Jersey. The royal family refused to do anything.
Well, the point is that what you've got, if it's intelligence agencies behind all of this, they will want to get people dirtied up, whether they're in the royal family, the Freemasons or whatever. It's the political goals behind it all which people need to get their head around. And I'm afraid that we have forces at work in our society, which the Queen said, of which we know nothing, but I think we know pretty much what goes on. They have been involved in using child sex as a political means of blackmail, and they've also been engaged in orchestrating terrorist attacks. These are the two main things at which the intelligence services stand accused, although they will deny it blind, but then it's their job to deny things blind as they would see it.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On to the Minsk agreement now then, Martin, and this is the biggie from the week from the international news. The leaders of France, Germany, Ukraine and Russia all getting their heads together to decide what's going to happen in eastern Ukraine, and there's a ceasefire Saturday evening, I believe, just going to start. I suppose the big question is it going to hold, this ceasefire?
Well, the previous ceasefire has been undermined largely from the Ukrainian side. And the rebels
from Kiev, yeah,
from Kiev, and the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, have basically taken advantage of that to try and gain territory and so on before the ceasefire kicks in. What was missing from the Minsk agreement are two crucial elements. One is the rebels themselves. Putin doesn't necessarily speak on their behalf, and he cannot guarantee that they will sign anything. All he can say is, I will ask them to sign it and I will recommend it, but that people shouldn't assume that these people are puppets of Putin. It's quite possible that they will be taking a harder line than Putin himself is taking.
Well, also,
more than likely, in fact.
Also, the Crimea is cited all the time as, oh, Putin's annexed Crimea. Just to explain for a minute the strategic significance of Crimea, because this is where the Black Sea Fleet is based, isn't it? And that is actually quite important, involved, for example, in the conflict in Syria and Israel.
Well, it's a crucial part of the Russians' strategic posture is to control Crimea. But the fact is, I just read a thing about an opinion poll carried out by a pro-Western opinion, German opinion poll organisation, which showed that something like 85% of people in Crimea now are still determined to be part of Russia, do not want to be part of the Ukraine. And so, in many ways, Putin's hand was forced there by sentiment on the ground. The idea that Putin and the Russian government are orchestrating both what's happening in the Crimea and in eastern Ukraine is simply wrong.
Well, look,
the people there are taking a harder line than the Russian government in Moscow.
The crucial thing that's being compared to is the annexation, the Nazi annexation of Austria or the Sudetenland. These kind of annexations.
Well, I mean, but each case is uniquely different, and all of this stuff going on about how Putin's the new Hitler is laughable. In Kiev, in the key ministries of military and intelligence and police, are being run by neo-Nazis who openly identify with Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. They are the ones who are trying to annex the eastern Ukraine and Crimea, and they don't want to be annexed.
The
analogy is simply wrong.
Okay, let's compare this, for example, to Catalonia. For example, they're thinking that they don't really want to have much to do anymore, in fact, with Madrid, because people all across Europe are starting to say, well, hang on a minute, we're paying loads of money in tax, but we're not seeing our infrastructure being built, and it's not being spent, it's just going to pay debts now.
Well, look, there are each of these conflicts is unique. There are elements that are similar, and there are elements which are unique. And you can't just read off from one conflict to another or whatever. When Yugoslavia was broken up, you could argue that that breakaway republics should not have been encouraged by Western policy to simply walk out of Yugoslavia, leaving other republics still in Yugoslavia, who then had to walk out subsequently with a lot of bloodshed of all kinds. And of course, the Indian Federation are looking at this with alarm, because they've got secessionist tendencies, whatever. I think all of these things are manageable, as the Northern Ireland crisis has ultimately been manageable, if there is a willingness to listen to different sides' point of view and to recognise that there's going to be differences in those points.
But So how do we decide? I mean, for example, in Spain, here we got also in Ukraine, in Yugoslavia, as you were talking about, how does a region decide whether it's actually got the right to secede from the centre when they've had enough?
You've got to decide whether it's a where do you draw the border of a region? I mean, I would suggest that the rebels in the East Ukraine are probably, in their aspirations, wanting to liberate further areas of Ukraine where people are in sympathy with their views. And, of course, what I think the strategy at the moment is to get Luhansk and Donetsk, liberated from Ukraine in the sense of not being run from Kiev, although the Russian government are insisting that, you see, Putin's interest is to have them in the Ukrainian Federation so that they can vote in Ukrainian presidential and parliamentary elections and therefore dilute the potentially far-right element coming in from the West Ukraine. Although in Galicia, which is even the very far west of Ukraine, they are thinking of a seceding as well. And it's quite possible that the Ukraine, which is a state that's only existed since 1991, will simply not exist. That happens all the time. It's possible that the United Kingdom, which has existed since 1707, won't exist by the end of 2015. The world is changing. The point is, all of these things are negotiable, as the Northern Ireland peace process shows. By a common sense attitude all round, it's possible to come to agreement. But what's happened here, a bigger picture, is that the neocons in the United States of America want a crisis in the Ukraine to tie the Russians' hands. Brzezinski, the advisor to Carter from the 70s, he's saying he wants to send weaponry to Ukraine which will allow them to carry out urban warfare and bog down the Russian forces in urban warfare in the big cities in the Ukraine. That's the kind of way they're talking. And a war in the Ukraine suits their book because it ties Putin's hands, which allows us to carry on promoting war in Syria and across the Middle East. What we've got, in fact, is a warmongering oligarchy in the West.
But you say in the West, but are the Europeans going to have this war? The Americans certainly want them
to. Well, the Europeans are the ones who are going to have to fight it. The Americans are just the ones who want to supply the weapons.
So what about
it?
The Germans and the French? Do they want it?
This is a question, isn't it?
The leadership?
I think they have been pushed into a very difficult position. I've been reading some very interesting things about Merkel and Hollande's visit to the Kremlin, because they went into a confab with Putin and Poroshenko. Well, Poroshenko came along in Minsk, but they were in Moscow with Putin, and all the officials apart from translators were removed. And of course, in the Kremlin, Merkel and Hollande can be pretty confident that the NSA can't be listening to what they're saying. Now, the positive spin on that is that Merkel, as we've been advice from previous German chancellors, advice from her industrial base and so on, saying, look, we don't want a war with Russia, fix it for us. But on the other hand, in public, she's still banging the same old drum about Putin's got to do this, do that, do the other.
Well, I thought, hang on, the NSA are bugging her phone, aren't they?
Yes, but presumably the Russians will have asked her to turn her phone off before she went into their meeting. But this is a potentially important turning point. If the Germans, and they're using the French as cover, we're talking about the Germans here, the Germans need to get sensible in the way they deal with the Greeks, and they need to get sensible they deal with the Russians, and they need to get a bit more realistic about the way they deal with the British and the Americans. Like, basically, our time in Britain and America of telling the Germans what to do is over. And it's the Germans' responsibility to keep the peace here and to tell the warmongers in Washington and London that we're not going down that road. And I hope Frau Merkel has the backbone for it.
We've just heard a couple of hours ago on the BBC News website, Ukraine crisis, fierce fighting after the Minsk peace deal. Intense fighting has been reported in eastern Ukraine a day after the peace deal. Fiercest battles were over control of the town of Debaltseve, a strategic town in between rebel-held areas. The group responsible for monitoring the ceasefire due to start at midnight on Saturday said there's still serious live fire in several areas.
Well, the point is that before a ceasefire kicks in, everybody fights to try and get as maximum territory as they can before the ceasefire kicks in. If the ceasefire kicks in and it holds, it will be because Putin is restraining the rebels. The rebels, in fact, are on a roll. And they would like to carry at this point. Kiev was breaking the ceasefire all along. The rebels agreed to the ceasefire last September. Kiev kept on provoking them, and that's because they are being pushed by the Israelis and by the Americans to keep the war in Ukraine boiling, to keep Putin busy, so that they can move their other pieces on the chessboard in the Middle East. Very unfortunate for the Ukrainians. But, I mean, this is all turning, you know, it's almost like we've reached the point now where there is no turning back. The Ukrainian economy is collapsing. there is going to be a showdown economically and politically across the world.
But this is pretty nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because we've had Saddam the bogeyman, we've had Gaddafi the bogeyman, Assad the bogeyman, now it's Putin the bogeyman. This could go nuclear.
It could, but more likely it's just going to go conventional, at which point the Russians are in a very strong position to win. The question is, will NATO accept defeat without using nuclear weapons? And I don't think people like John McCain come across as having any common sense about this whatsoever. But there's a kind of groupthink taking control in America now, where they see arming the Ukraine as a test of virility. I think that alarms the Germans, who are a rather conservative disposition, which is why they don't like printing money and they don't like going off to wars which they can't, you know, which they don't want to get themselves into.
Yes, but they've printed the money. Will they go for the war as well?
Well, what they need to do is show more flexibility with Greece. I mean, they're trapped by their own rhetoric. The idea that Putin started this crisis is patently wrong. This crisis was begun by the neocons in Washington, who worked with the far right in Ukraine to overthrow the democratically elected government by shooting protesters.
That's almost a year ago,
those protesters who were protesting for a more liberal Ukraine were shot down, not by pro-Russian snipers, but by far right snipers linked to our intelligence services here in this country, to MI6, no doubt.
Well, have you got any evidence for that?
I've got evidence that MI6 was involved in such activities in the past. I very much.
Well, that's not evidence.
No,
for
but,
Kiev,
but,
is it?
But the point is, I suggest that if people want to look about what to do to solve this crisis, they need to look nearer to home than to Moscow.
Well, the BBC.
But this crisis has been escalated at every stage by neocon provocateurs
Martin, the BBC, not in the Russian intelligence. Newsnight earlier this week, I think it was Wednesday evening, had a report all about a year on from the Kiev coup, where they explained that there were, in fact they spoke to some guy who was his face was hidden, who said that he was one of the snipers and they were firing near the police but not at the police. One of the experts used in that was the guy who was in charge of security at the Maidan protests. That's Anton Paribi.
Yes, well, Paribi has been put in by the BBC. Paribi is a suspect for this. So the guy
Why is he a suspect?
Because it was Pravi's sector were in control of the places where all the shooting was coming from. Omas Pirts, who was the Estonian foreign minister, was bugged phoning Catherine Ashton, who was the British foreign representative of the EU, and he said he'd been round the hospitals, and what he was hearing from everybody was that all of the people had been shot by the same people using the same caliber weapons, and they were professional snipers, and the word he was getting in the hospitals was it was all coming from areas under the control of Paribi and Pravi sector. You see, the neo-Nazis are not in full control in the Ukraine. It's an alliance between neoliberal economist types and neo-Nazis. The neo-Nazis are in charge, though, of the police, the security and the military policy. And they, of course, have a vested interest in escalating. And they, of course, are in alliance with people like John McCain in order to escalate. I mean, the way for this ceasefire to break down is quite simple. They just won't recognise it. They'll just carry on fighting. And that, of course, that's what John McCain wants them to do. And he said they are using cluster bombs. John McCain the other day said, yes, we know they're using cluster bombs on civilians, but that's because we didn't give them proper weaponry. I mean, that's the sort of stuff he comes out with. And, of course, he's also an ally of ISIS. He's met with al-Baghdadi. There's photographs of him. So the far right in the US are in alliance with the far right in the Ukraine and the far right Islamists in Syria. And then they want to say, oh, well, you can see the pernicious and evil actions that they're carrying out. And the Russians have been very, very patient under a great deal of provocation. And I'm afraid the problem for Merkel and Hollande is they've gone along with this nonsense over a whole year, and it's very hard now for them to step back from all the silly things they've said. For example, we could come back to the MH17 shoot down. The evidence is overwhelming that it was carried out by Kiev. Now, what may happen as we go to real confrontation between Russia and the West is that the Russians are going to get out their satellite images, their telephone intercepts and all the rest of it, and prove beyond any shadow of a doubt to Western public opinion that their own intelligence services are terrorists. And they don't want to do that because it's a very extreme step. But ultimately, of course, what we're talking about is our leaders being sent to Nuremberg.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, the Reverend Stephen Sizer has been banned from social media over his 9/11 conspiracy post. That's a controversial pro-Palestinian vicar, Reverend Stephen Sizer, banned from writing, preaching, teaching, emailing, tweeting or posting on Facebook or commenting in any way in relation to the current situation in the Middle East, because he linked to a article entitled 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World. He didn't actually post the whole item, he just linked to it saying, the question is this anti-Semitic?
Yes, well, I think this is very interesting. He's been a bête noire for the Zionist lobby in this country for many years.
He's written several books on Zionism and Christian Zionism particularly.
Yeah, well, he's obviously got, you know, he's in the sights of the pro-Zionist lobby. And obviously he's linked to this article. And I actually suggest anybody listening to this, if you want to know about Israel's links to 9/11, then Google the relevant article, which all of this fuss has actually brought into prominence. Because I'm afraid there is quite a lot of evidence that Israel was involved. I don't suppose they did it on their own. I don't suppose the fascists in the Ukraine did what they did on their own. But the idea that the intelligence services of Israel do not engage in terrorism is laughable. They do engage in terrorism. So do our own. So do MI6. So to the CIA. I'm quite sure the FSB do as well, but we hear all about that. We don't hear about what our lot get up to.
So why all the controversy around this? Why can't the Zionists be just treated like anybody else as a possible suspect?
Well, why can't the brethren say what he wants without being told to shut up? I think it's rather extraordinary of him to have signed this thing saying he's not going to talk about Middle East politics at all.
Well, he's obviously, so he keeps his job, that's why.
Well, I think that's rather strange. I think he should have just told them to stick it. In actual fact, of course, what the Zionist lobby here has done is rather foolish, because they've actually drawn attention to the fact that 9/11 possibly had an Israeli component. And this, of course, is exactly what the Russians are going to do if we go to war with
church
them. They're going to bring out their satellite imagery and various other evidences that they have, which are, because I'm pretty sure that the FSB know pretty well who carried out 9/11.
What the church is saying, Martin, is it's anti-Semitic. He shouldn't be posting this stuff.
Well, that's based on the idea that to suggest that the state of Israel could be involved in terrorism must be anti-Semitic. But in actual fact, the evidence for the state of Israel's involvement in terrorism is overwhelming. The Lavon affair in the 1950s was a situation where American and British targets were being attacked in Egypt, supposedly blamed on Islamic extremists. The people were caught. They were Mossad agents.
Well, I'll post a link up to the article, which is on the excellent WikiSpooks site. I don't think it was actually written by them,
no.
But they've got a one of the best examples of that, which is very well presented, easy to read and navigate around. I mean, for example, some of the headings on there is Zionist control of the World Trade Center complex, World Trade Center security in Zionist hands, pre-knowledge of the anthrax mailings, and also airport security in Israeli hands.
Yeah, ICTS, who are based by Shin Bet. Now, what really annoys me about all of this is that the mainstream media keeps banging on about a war on terror, war on terror. We want to get half the news is about terrorism, but they don't want to talk about factual matters. They just want to go on and on and on about the Muslims this, the Muslims that. Now, as anybody will tell you who's been around any kind of war in Yugoslavia, Northern Ireland, anywhere else, it's all about the detail. ICTS, for example, a Shin Bet linked security company, private company in control of all three airports on 9/11 and in control of Schiphol Airport when the so-called underpants bomber gets on without a security check. The idea that the Israeli state is a terrorist entity is a perfectly straightforward proposal. It's not nothing strange about it. It's quite straightforward. And since we're going to move on in a minute to talk about Gladio, the Western intelligence services, not just Mossad, MI5, MI6, DGSE, they are terrorists. Every bit as terrorist as the provisional IRA. And that's what the ordinary folks of this country had better understand, because we're getting very close to the edge now.
Martin, I think it's probably a good idea to just sum up why you think that it's not anti-Semitic to talk about these things which are involving Zionists, Jewish people, etc.
Anti-Semitism is the hatred and dislike of Jews for being Jews, and that of course is absolutely unacceptable, and it's racist and intolerable, and it's the same as being as any other group. There's no doubt in my mind that should be the case. But on the other hand, the state of Israel is a human creation run by human beings, and some of those human beings are terrorists, just as some of the people running this country are terrorists, because they've been working with terrorists in Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Afghanistan and lots of other places. And I think it's about time we called a spade, because otherwise we're going to go over the Niagara Falls of World War III and we won't even know what's happening.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On now to continue with our listen to the professor from Switzerland. I love this guy. It's like Switzerland is almost immune to much of this. Sitting there during World War II, watching various people fighting around it, making lots of money in the process over in Switzerland. But at Basel University, you'll find a chap called Professor Daniela Ganser. He's the author of a book called NATO's Secret Armies. And here he is, following on from last week's interview, talking about something called Operation Northwoods. But before we hear about it, let's hear Martin's summary of what Operation Northwoods was about and why it's significant.
Operation Northwoods, uncovered by Freedom of Information requests, the idea was, it was in 1964, they wanted to overthrow Castro, so the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by Lyman Lemnitzer, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the US, put forward a plan to McNamara and Kennedy, who were the political leadership, saying what we're going to do is we're going to hijack various planes in the US, we're going to crash them into buildings, we're going to have bombs going off, we're going to say it's the Cubans, and on the back of that we're going to invade Cuba. And we want a nice long casualty list of civilians to get the population going. And it's all in the documents, which were official documents produced at the time, which became to light some years later.
So here we are with Daniela Ganser then on Operation Northwoods.
The CIA wanted to overthrow Fidel Castro with the so-called Bay of Pigs invasion in April 1961. This failed, and then Kennedy turned to the Pentagon and said, you know, the guys from the CIA messed it up. Do you have a better idea how we could get rid of Fidel Castro? And then the Pentagon generals sat together and drew up a plan. And today, this is more than 50 years later, we have the original document. At the time, it was top secret, but it is now in our hands, in the hands of the historians. And Lyman Lemnitzer was at the time the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So for those who are not familiar with the military hierarchies, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is the highest officer, okay, of the entire military. So he's the boss of the Pentagon, if you want. The Pentagon obviously being the U.S. Defense Ministry. And above him, you have the defense minister, but he's not an officer, he's a civilian. And you have the vice president and the president. That's the chain of command. And if you look at what this chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lemnitzer, came up with, the idea that he came up with, then you're really baffled, because you see that military officers at time think of, you know, manipulating terrorism. The document is dated March 13, 1962, and what the generals suggest is, we could remember the main incident could be arranged in several forms, and then I quote, we could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Okay? Once again, the idea was, Guantanamo Bay, obviously being the U.S. base on Cuba, where you have now this torture debate, but at the time they had American ships there, and they said, we ourselves could blow up a U.S. ship and then say Fidel did it. I mean, this is the thinking. And that is this called false flag strategy of tension terror. Another thing that he says, and I quote, we could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington, exploding a few plastic bombs in carefully chosen spot, the arrest of Cuban agents, and the release of prepared document substantiating Cuban involvement also would be helpful in projecting the idea of an irresponsible government. End of quote. So let me just explain what this means. It means the Pentagon generals planned to carry out terrorist attacks in Florida, in Washington, and in Miami, and then blame them on Fidel Castro. They don't write here whether people will be killed in these terrorist attacks or not, but it actually says we should do that, and we should then arrest Cuban agents, you know, arrest some people and say, you know, you did it. And we should release prepared documents, documents that you prepare before and then plant them, which then show that Cuba did it. Although, obviously, in this case, you know, it would be all fake. It would be all a hoax. It would be all fraud. It would be all lies.
And wasn't there another suggestion about downing a passenger aircraft and then sort of playing on people's sympathies by saying, oh, well, it was full of young people on their way to voluntary work or something?
Yeah, yeah, true indeed. That's another page of the same document. It actually says, we take a drone, so that's an unnamed aircraft, And we bring it over Cuba, and then we have it explode by interior bomb and remote control. So nobody would die. But we would say this is a normal civilian aircraft, which was downed by Fidel Castro. And, you know, we had young American girls who actually wanted to fly to, I think, Peru to help the poor who are undernourished. And then you would have a very emotional story. And that is actually always the idea of false flag terrorism, of manipulated terrorism, to shock the public, because the public would then not think, oh gee, that's probably, you know, a drone and probably brought to explosion by the Pentagon by remote control. They would never think that.
Dr. Julian Charles there, talking to another doctor, Daniela Ganser, author of NATO's Secret Armies. Now, Martin, terror in Miami and Washington, blowing up an American ship in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, they didn't carry out that plan at the time because McNamara and Kennedy said, you lot are nuts, what are you talking about? But of course then Kennedy was thereafter, not very long thereafter, assassinated. I think best historical evidence suggests that he was assassinated by his own security forces. Now that's how bad the rot is. From 1962 onwards, the military industrial complex and its minions have been assassinating the political leadership if they stood in the way of their various designs to manipulate public opinion through killing innocent civilians. Now, ultimately, the law is the answer to this, although, of course, at certain times, as in the eastern Ukraine and maybe in Northern Ireland during the 30 years of the Troubles, some people took the view that the law would have to be helped by their own activities. And, of course, the danger with that is that you then play into the hands of those who want conflict anyway. But I think the take-home that people have got to get, when Daniela Ganser said, well, people wouldn't think it was the Cubans, that was at the Pentagon, they wouldn't believe that. In 1962, they wouldn't. It's now 2015. The Pentagon is a terrorist organisation. Anybody with any pretense to historical knowledge must understand that. And of course the British intelligence services are implicated in the activities of our strongest ally.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Well, moving on to look now at the whole conflict in the Middle East, and again at ISIS, because there's been a couple of stories this week that have caught my eye, Martin. One is a former US CIA contractor talking about ISIS, and the other one is actually someone from ISIS themselves saying, actually, we're being funded from the United States.
Well, I mean, this is being openly said across the Middle East in reputable newspapers, you know, in Lebanon and elsewhere. It's only in Britain that we're fed this, I don't know what you'd call it, this baby-grade information about what's going on in Ukraine and the Middle East. Everywhere else in the world definitely regards the British and the Americans as extremely tricky, very dangerous, and extremely manipulative. But we, of course, see ourselves as the good guys who are being persecuted by people who don't share our values.
Yousef al-Salafi alleged the Pakistan commander of Islamic State, or Daesh, has confessed during investigations that he's been receiving funds through the US. Law enforcement agencies on January the 22nd claimed they arrested al-Salafi along with his two companions during a joint raid in Lahore. However, sources revealed that al-Salafi was actually arrested sometime in December last year. It was only disclosed on the 22nd of January. During the investigations, Yousef al-Salafi revealed he was getting funded, routed through America, to run the organisation in Pakistan and recruit young people to fight in Syria. A source privy to the investigations revealed in the Daily Express on the condition of anonymity. Al-Salafi is a Pakistani Syrian who entered Pakistan through Turkey 5 months ago. Earlier, as reported, he crossed into Turkey from Syria and was caught there. Now, there seems to be a bit of a conduit, doesn't there? Turkey, Syria, Pakistan. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, the whole jihadi network was created by CIA and MI6 in the 1980s in Operation Cyclone. There's a film about it called Charlie Wilson's War, in which Hollywood boasts of the duplicitous way in which the Russians were forced out of Afghanistan by Western money, Wahhabi terrorists, and all the rest of it. And that has carried on. Basically, the more extreme militant groups are all of them run by Western intelligence services.
Well, let's hear now from the former CIA contractor about ISIS being, a completely fabricated enemy and funded by the United States. That's Stephen D. Kelly.
With respect to the issue of the United States taking military action against ISIS, my response to the people that have been asking me about this is that if you want to get to the root of the problem and remove this organization, the first thing they need to do is remove the funding and take care of the entities responsible for the creation of this group. And that would bring the forces here at home, because clearly this is entirely a farce. This is a completely fabricated enemy. The funding is completely from the United States and its allies. And for people to think that this enemy is something that needs to be attacked in Syria or Iraq is a farce, because this is something that we created, that we control, and only now it has become convenient for us to attack this group as a legitimate enemy. Clearly, when they say that they don't need permission to go into Syria and attack that country, one can only imagine how long it will be before they are dropping bombs on the home of Bashar Assad. So I think that the American public, I would like to believe that they are not completely ignorant of the source of this, but obviously these tactics that they are using with the executions, the videotaped executions or alleged executions, are designed to create massive amounts of fear and cause a response here at home, or a knee-jerk reaction, if you will.
There is Stephen D. Kelly. Martin, pretty simple stuff. He's saying that actually they could shut it down tomorrow if they wanted to.
Yeah, they don't want to. And for people out there who think that the British and American governments are opposed to Wahhabi extremism is laughable. Our closest ally, Saudi Arabia, who keeps a lot of people in overtime up in Filton, are the main funders for ISIS, and they're doing it fully in full knowledge and cooperation with our own security forces. Now, ultimately, we are going to deal with terrorism, and it's going to be more straightforward than people think, because we just have to look closer to home and make it stick. Oh. And then a lot of terrorism would be knocked on the head.
Okay, finally tonight, let's hear from John Lennon back in the 1970s talking about who he thinks runs the world, not just the Western world, China and Russia, and his view on it all.
I think our society is run by insane people for insane objects, objectives. And I think that's what I sussed when I was 16 and 12, way down the line. But I expressed it differently all through my life. It's the same thing I'm expressing all the time, but now I can put it into that sentence that I think we're being run by maniacs for maniacal ends, you know. If anybody can put on paper what our government and the American government, etc., what they are actually trying to do, you know, and how, what they think they're doing, I'd be very pleased to know what they think they're doing. I think they're all insane, you know, but I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. You know, that's what's insane about it.
Every country's had a violent revolution for one reason or the other. Not one of them has the freedom we're all talking about. So we're saying give peace a chance, you know, like nobody's ever done it before. We're not thinking in terms of 10 years. We're thinking in terms of peace forever, you know. And everybody's talking about now. I want peace now. We can get peace now if we want it now. And the left wing talk about giving the power to the people. You know, anybody knows that the people have the power. All we have to do is awaken the power in the people. The people are unaware. It's like they're not educated to realize that they have power. They put the politicians in power. They vote for the local mayor. The people do it. But the system is so geared that everybody believes that the father will fix everything, the father being the government. Government will fix everything. It is all government's fault. Shake a fist at the government. Well, we are the government. The people are the government, and the people have the power, but we must try and make them aware of this. As a Beatle, we made it, and there was nothing to do. We had money, we had fame, and there was no joy. And then I met Yoko, So we decided the thing we had in common was love, and from love came peace. So we decided to work for world peace.
And how do you do that?
We do it by... that we believe that today's society, advertising is the thing politicians use and commercial companies use, the Beatles use it, John and Yoko should use it. Our product is peace.
Have less words and more peace. I think the only way to do it is Gandhi's way. And that's non-violent, passive, positive, or whatever they called it those days. You know?
That's John Lennon there speaking in the 1970s about peace, the Gandhian way. Time to sign off now from the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. Our sister show Dialects on Mondays at 11, second of the pair of guest-produced programmes by psychedelic rock band The Transpersonals. Thanks to our guest, Ron Stone, in the first hour. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, and you can follow me in between shows at Tony Gosling on Twitter. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the former TV weatherman Fred Talbert has been convicted of indecent assault on two schoolboys while working as a teacher in the 1970s. Kevin Gover reports.
Back in the 1980s, Fred Talbert was a familiar face joking around on the TV weather map of ITV's This Morning.
Being outside gives me a tan. It's perfect. Right, what have we got for Oregon, Scotland?
Fast forward 25 years, he wasn't quite so vocal when being questioned.
I think those asterisks mean you, every time you've had sex... No comment.
His trial heard he'd abused the trust of his pupils, often under the influence of alcohol. Detective Constable Chris Doggart.
He has accepted no responsibility for his crimes.
Altrincham Grammar School says its thoughts are with the former pupils subjected to the abuse. He'll be sentenced next month.
Pink Floyd founder Roger Waters has joined a protest outside the US embassy calling for Guantanamo Bay prisoner Shaka Amer to be released. The Saudi citizen's UK-based family is urging the US government to release him, as he's never been charged with a crime. Fierce fighting in eastern Ukraine has killed at least 25 people since yesterday ahead of a planned ceasefire this weekend. Russia and the UN have said they are confident that all groups will respect the truce from Sunday. Young people appear to be driving a new generation of teetotalers. Close to a third of under-24s say they don't drink. That's up from a fifth a decade ago. Fewer are binge drinking as well. These students are seeing the difference.
There has definitely been a noticeable decline in the drinking culture. The bar's not as busy anymore.
I work like 6 days a week. I'm not going to want to go out and spend the money I'm earning. I'm trying to earn to live.
Yeah, you see more people in the library than you actually do on a night out these days, because people want to actually get their work done.
The head of HSBC has described the scandal over its Swiss arm this week as painful and frustrating. The chief executive has written to his staff, admitting the bank has failed to meet expected standards. And Boris Johnson insists he's no ambition to become prime minister. London's leader has told reporters in Washington, D.C. he'll see what happens after his term as mayor ends. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.